versus David Dennis Brown et al. We will begin.
Good morning, may it please the court. I'm Jordan Collins, Superintendent from Houston. I represent Dr. Patel. I will initially thank the court for allowing us to file over in large briefs because of the length of the record and the issues presented. Bottom line, Dr. Patel's case, she was acquitted of conspiracy of wire fraud, acquitted of one count of health care fraud, convicted of the other counts. It's my sincere position that the evidence is insufficient as a matter of law to show both guilty knowledge and willfulness per part. What exacerbates, I believe, this trial and this record is the fact that the government chose not to offer any medical expert testimony. Kimberly Coffey, one of the durable equipment regional carrier employees, was called basically to talk about Medicare protocols and criteria. She in fact confirmed that the government's position with respect to the definition of standard care confined that portion of the criteria, in fact, was not what the government had concluded it must get to. The problem in this case, with respect to guilty knowledge and willfulness, at least on Dr. Patel's part, is that the Medicare criteria is contained in handbooks that are ultimately disseminated to the teamworks of the regional carriers, who in turn disseminate that to the durable medical equipment providers. They do not provide that information to the physicians. And this is important because, as we have cited in our brief, based upon investigations conducted by the Office of the Inspector General of Health and Human Services, and based upon testimony before the United States Senate Finance Committee.
Well, I want to ask you about this. There seemed to be a couple of instances where you and other defendant or defendants claimed that even though documents weren't presented as evidence at trial, that somehow we can take judicial notice of them for reviewing sufficiency of the evidence in a criminal case. I'm just not sure how that works. So how can you justify our doing that?
I believe, Your Honor, that under, I believe, Rule 201 D of the Federal Rules of Evidence, judicial notice can be taken even on appeal of government records and of records in the public domain. What we're talking about here, in fact, as you've seen no doubt in the reply brief that we filed, I'm not relying totally on evidence that was placed before the Senate Finance Committee by the Inspector General of HHS, but also published opinions, which are in the domain, which talk in terms of the fact that the Medicare criteria that was alive and well during the term of this indictment, in fact, has been jettisoned because it's confusing. Doctors did not understand it. I'm not suggesting that the new criteria applies to the conduct in question, but it is an indication of the state of affairs with respect to trying to determine whether or not doctors truly understood what the criteria was. But I think, to answer your question, Judge Barksdale, I think it's absolutely appropriate for the court to be able to take judicial notice of sworn testimony by the Office of the Inspector General of Health.
Well, maybe that would be more appropriate to present in district court post-trial. I'm just not sure. I want to ask you about another point. You urge on a sufficiency of the evidence on mens rea. The government claims you didn't raise this at trial, that while you did move for judgment of acquittal, this was not a specific issue raised. So how about covering that for us, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. In fact, with all respect to my learned colleague, I disagree. Mr. Schaefer spent most of his time, as I point out in the briefs, talking about the legal insufficiency of the evidence with respect to conspiracy, but he turned then to the substantive counts. In fact, made a specific comment, I'm not quoting right off the top of my head, but said, hope you weren't thinking that we were conceding intent with respect to the substantive offenses. Judge Gilmore says, absolutely, counsel, I understand you're not. Then he went on and spoke about intent, spoke about the fact she had no guilty knowledge, and then that was denied. And then at the close of the government's case, after the defense had put on evidence, he specifically re-urged and re-adopted the motion for judgment of acquittal. He didn't ad nauseum go through all subparts, but the court nor the government at any time indicated they weren't aware of the specific argument he had made before. And finally, as we have argued at the after the conclusion of the case, pursuant to Rule 29C, a post-verdict judgment of acquittal was moved for as well. The citation, the authority that the government cites, Your Honor, is a case that wholly an opposite. In that situation, the defendant contended that the photographs or video was not obscene and never raised sufficiency. In our case, we have.
All right.
Thank you.
May I please report, John Pizzell for Dr. Skirka. I want first to address a few of the issues as to the conspiracy and counts.
Well, I want to cover with you your claiming that even though you didn't object to the deliberate ignorance instruction, that somehow you can object now because at some point prior to trial, the court said one objection by all is an objection by one objection, an objection by one is an objection by all. But at the charge conference, when the judge asked, is there any problem with this, what did you try the case?
No, Your Honor.
All right. What was the response of counsel for Stripka when the instructions were given or the court gave you the charge or whatever and nothing was said by Stripka about the deliberate ignorance instruction?
Stripka's trial counsel, when asked if he had any objections, said no objections.
Right.
But in the context, Mr. Schaefer on behalf of Patel had argued the deliberate ignorance issue.
Right.
And the judge had made clear through her order that...
Prior to trial.
Right. And I did file a supplemental list of authorities this morning with two cases in support of this. One is a Fifth Court in the United States versus Ramon, stating that unless people opt out of such a thing that...
Even though, but you opted out, you, counsel for Stripka, opted out when the judge said any objections, he said no objections. So the no objections swallowed the earlier, if you agree with everything, you don't basically have to say anything. I just don't see how you can say no objections to the judge at trial, so the judge gives the instruction. Then you come here on, you know, to us and say, oh, no, we adopted the objections because the judge had said prior to trial, if anybody objected, we piggyback.
Well,
that might be called invited error.
Well, and the purpose of the objection rule, as pointed out in Bernal and the First Circuit case, which I cited in the list of stories, is to make sure that the district court is on notice of what the issues are and is not materially misled. And I don't think there's any way to believe that Judge Gilmore didn't know that the defense would object to a deliberate ignorance instruction. Especially in a white-collar case, you never fail to object to a deliberate ignorance.
Well, apparently counsel for Stripka did. He said no objections.
Well, but my take on it was in the context of the lengthy discussion with trial counsel for Patel.
Well, that's a problem here that all of the defendants say we adopt each other's briefs. You can't adopt a brief where it's fact-specific or an issue of law that's pertaining only to one defendant. You just can't do that. But, you know, we'll look at the record. I just was curious as to how you would try to explain to us that your counsel can say no objections and then say, oh, wait, I'm going to have this safe harbor of somebody else objected to a jury instruction, and, you know, we'll just see how it falls out.
I did want to address a couple arguments I think that the government will make to show knowledge on Dr. Stripka's part as far as the fraud. I think that they will focus on the fact that Dr. her was he didn't want these other doctors knowing about these kickbacks. And the...
All the more important to have objected to trial on deliberate ignorance. I mean, that is a great metaphor for deliberate ignorance. I had my door shut.
Right, and if trial counsel did not preserve that error, I believe he should have, and I think it was unreasonable for him not to. But I can't address that here.
Yeah, that's another chapter.
Right. The other thing was that Dr. Skripka did continue working at the clinic, but he was told by Dr. Gottlieb that the reason for the investigation was that this was about Medicare believing they were evaluating non-existent patients. And that's the normal Medicare scam, is non-existent patients. And Dr. Skripka knew that he was evaluating patients, and as we've argued in the brief, those the CMNs, in our position, is that those were self-contained, and that's what the doctor should have been allowed to rely upon and exercise his judgment in whether or not a patient qualified under the CMN for the wheelchair. And also, there was no evidence that Kimberly Coffey, who was the fraud investigator, tried to insinuate that Dr. Skripka, by allowing Dr. Gottlieb to use his UPIN, was misleading Medicare about who was providing his services. But there was no law or regulation put into evidence that this was improper, and the testimony was that this was common practice, actually, in medicine to allow an employer or a hospital to use a UPIN.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Jamie Maselli, and I represent Mr. Pius James Akiko. Due to my limited time, I'm going to focus on issue two, where we allege that Mr. Akiko was denied the presumption of innocence. The well-known quote from Berger versus United States is that while a prosecutor may strike hard blows, he's not at liberty to strike foul ones. But I actually went on and read the entire case last evening, and I found something interesting. The court explained, it's fair to say that the average jury, in a greater or lesser degree, has confidence that these obligations, which so plainly rest upon the prosecuting attorney, will be faithfully observed. Improper suggestions and insinuations are apt to carry much weight against the accused when they should properly carry none. In this case, the government averts that when the prosecutor said over defense objection, he's a co-conspirator, that it referred to the testifying witness, not Mr. Akiko. However, co means two. You can't be a co-conspirator without two of you. And so we allege under either theory that you believe they're referring to Mr. Gello, and that's not my theory. We prefer that they're allege that they're referring to Mr. Akiko as the co-conspirator, that by doing that, it sends the message, the insinuation to the jury, he's already a conspirator. He's convicted of conspiracy before the jury has even heard all the evidence.
And play out the procedure that followed when this was done for us. Review that for us.
There was no objection. But I believe that this court still has plain error. I know at the Court of Criminal Appeals they don't, but we still in the Fifth Circuit can allege plain error.
At the Court of Criminal Appeals?
Well, I was saying in state court we don't have plain error. That's why I prefer federal court, because when there is an error of such magnitude, you can't raise it. And this was an error. And if the court believes that calling a defendant who's charged with conspiracy a co-conspirator by the U.S. attorney is not error, then I don't have an issue here. But I do believe that taking away the...
But it's not just that it's error. It's got to be reversible plain error, and then it's got to be da-da-da-da-da that we would use our discretion to overturn the error. And it, you know... You just have to look at the record.
I would like to do this plain error.
Well, what about the context, though? It wasn't like he got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, co-conspirator, co-conspirator. Instead, he was arguing an objection and using sort of inside baseball language in responding. And isn't that, I mean, somewhat typical to speak about an evidentiary ruling in legalistic terms, and is there even any thought that the jury would be focusing on that because they kind of zone out from the objections?
I would presume the jury's not zoning out and listening to what the prosecutor is averring to. That's what Berger versus United States says, that insinuations and suggestions by prosecutors are taken very seriously by the court.
But they're not. The jury knows when an objection is made, that's being directed to the judge and not to them. And so, I mean, I don't mean zoning out in a bad way. They just aren't part of that. So they don't like the objection process because they're not part of it. So in terms of insinuations, do you have a case where it's being done in this context? Because if we're going to find plain error, we need to have a rule that says prosecutors can't use those kinds of words even in arguing objections, even though that is the argument, the legal argument.
Well, I don't know of any case that would allow a prosecutor to take away the presumption of innocence in front of the jury during an objection. Like somehow they get a free pass if it's an
objection. But do you have a case that says this is error, what the context in which the prosecutor said?
Not within the context, only within the constitutional right to the presumption of innocence.
May it please the court, my name is Jamal Pavlich, and I represent Mr. David Dennis Brown, and I was his trial counsel also.
Now, Mr. Gudnitz, do you agree, because you didn't file a reply brief, so I don't know what your position is, the government maintains that your issue about the enhancement from manager or supervisor, that no objection was made to this at sentencing, so once again, this would be a plain error standard of review, and because you didn't file a reply brief, or if you did, I don't have it, I don't know what your response is.
We did file an objection during the prior to sentencing, Your Honor, and the argument that we raised was that that Mr. Brown was not a manager or supervisor of the activity that was engaged in health fraud. I mean, the evidence that came up during the course of the trial was that what the government was trying to present to the jury was that Mr. Brown had employed a number of people and he had brought approximately 520-some-odd patients into the clinic, and that Mr. Brown had gone ahead and paid these people $50 as an incentive to come to that clinic. That's not what the evidence was during the course of the trial. The evidence, there was one individual, Mr. Hamilton, who did testify that it was Mr. Brown who had, that it's his personal knowledge that Mr. Brown had in fact paid him and other people. However, what the government failed to do was either corroborate Mr. Hamilton's information or provide any information from anyone to show that he did in fact pay this $50 incentive. In fact, what happened during the course of the trial was that the patients, the individuals that the government had called as witnesses, testified that Mr. Brown had nothing. It was only Mr. Hamilton who had information to that effect.
So where are we going to find your objection to the manager-supervisor enhancement that was sought by the government and imposed by the court?
Well, the argument that you raised with the trial court...
No, sir. Where are we going to find it? Was it in writing before sentencing?
Yes,
is that during sentencing you urged it?
It was during sentencing, Your Honor, and there was an objection that we filed to the pre-sentence investigation report.
And in that objection, you said he should not receive manager supervisor because XYZ?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Well, we'll look for it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You still have another minute if you want to use it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. One of the other points I wanted to raise was that while Mr. Hamilton did provide information as to some of the names of some of the participants in the driving of the patients from Louisiana to Houston and solicitation of the patients, none of that information was corroborated in any way by the government. And
counsel, good morning. Did Patel know or have reason to believe that she made false misrepresentations or false statements on the government form 843s, the certificates of medical necessity, the CMNs, and issue or execute prescriptions that were going to Medicare for the 10 people who came into the jury room and the 10 counts, the substantive counts that she was convicted of? My name is Jeff Babcock. I represent the United States, and I'm from Houston. I'm going to get back to Patel in just a minute, but let me address Mr. Brown. The sentencing transcript for Mr. Brown is found at Brown Record 448, and the addendum to Brown's PSR reflects there were no objections, and there were no objections at the sentencing proceeding, and I point that out on pages 3 and 5.
Let me suggest, Mr. Godnich, if you would file a letter and point us to the point in the brief, in the record where you say this is, or state that perhaps you were mistaken. Either way, just respond after our oral argument in writing over the next day.
Yes, sir.
If we can get it by tomorrow, that'd be good. Obviously copy in AUSA.
Turning back to Ms. Patel, the answer to the question that I posed is yes.
Okay, I want to ask about Dr. Patel. On the form, she crossed out this thing about does the patient require and use a wheelchair to move around in the residence? She crossed out the and use. What is the significance as far as the mens rea of this and use?
Well, that's evidence.
Cross out.
First of all, it's evidence of her conscious disregard for and the subjective awareness of the knowledge of the facts.
But it seems to me if I cross out something in something I'm swearing, I swear that I am A and B, and I cross out B, I would perceive that I'm not swearing to B by doing that. I'm swearing only to A. And so while that may not be the best way to do it, why doesn't that at least take away her intent to defraud when she's saying, I'm not saying use because I'm crossing it out?
Well, the form itself does not indicate that there's an ability to excise portions that you don't agree with. And her testimony was that she struck it out because Dr. Gottlieb told her to do that. But the bottom line is that when you read the seven questions, the issue is whether the person at the present time needs the wheelchair or requires the wheelchair. And when she would cross out and use,
but can't you?
It didn't alter the question.
Counsel, can't you require a wheelchair but not be using one because you couldn't afford one, and so that's why you come in and you want Medicare to pay for it, and your doctor says, okay, I'm gonna be a good patient advocate, I'm gonna not be untruthful, I'll cross out and use, but we'll submit this and see what they do.
Well, they're not qualified then. You have to have a qualified Medicare beneficiary. You have to have, and these questions have to be answered in order to warrant the issuance of the money by Medicare or the Medicare provider.
Okay, but isn't it Medicare's responsibility to say we can't take any crossouts if you can't say the and use, we're rejecting this application?
That's one aspect, Your Honor. The other aspect is that she would write down for, you know, how long is somebody confined to the wheelchair. She wrote 8 hours for 2,000 people, including the 10 people that walked in to the courtroom and testified 3 years after she had executed the CMNs. She also answered, is the patient unable to operate any type of manual wheelchair? And she wrote, no, and that's not true either. And what the statement at the end of the document says is everything true, accurate, and correct that's on the form. And she signed that. And she testified that she knew that this was going to Medicare and that she knew that money would be issued by that. And she also knew that the prescriptions and these CMNs that were for the benefit of those 10 people that walked into the courtroom and testified, that she didn't give them to them. that those documents were going to go to the durable medical supplier. So those, first of all, this is that the jury had an opportunity to listen to her explanation for why she had executed these CMNs and why she crossed out the CMNs, and the jury didn't believe her.
Mr. Babcock, let me ask you on that. What they had were these forms, as Judge Haynes is, and you have been discussing, the end use is taken out. Assume in my question that we determine that that is, in fact, all she's certified to, that we have to take out the end use in our considerations. Where does that leave the validity, the criminality of these forms? Is there enough in the rest of the form to make your case?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's what we pointed out, the other two aspects that were not true. She explained the reason why I wrote 8 hours on the form, aside from the fact that she's relying on something that Dr. Gottlieb said, is that she said, I'm talking about in the future when they get a wheelchair, and that's not what the form says, and that's not what it is indicated there. And also her answers about the manual wheelchair. And I think if the court takes a look at the fact that 10 witnesses walked into the courtroom and they sat there and the jury had an opportunity to eyeball these witnesses and listen to their testimony and their ability to maneuver around. The purpose for these motorized wheelchairs is for people who can't get around in their house. You have people walking into this clinic and sitting down with Dr. Patel, talking to her, and they get up and they walk out. The jury saw these 10 people and watched them and listened to their testimony. What makes this case different is that Patel testified. And when she gave her explanation, the jury didn't credit it and didn't believe it. So her explanation I just lined that out because Gottlieb told me to, and that I think that it really meant whether they're going to be able to get a wheelchair. The thing is the jury didn't agree with that. They looked at that form, and this court has a case, the Ogba case, at page 232 that says, evidence of the conscious disregard for truth for what they were testifying about, that aspect, and to show actual knowledge, you look at the form, and if the form had been altered or changed or was untrue, that's evidence of her guilty knowledge. But that guilty knowledge, she had actual knowledge when these people walked in and she saw them. So you have that testimony, which was critical, and Mr. Seacrest spends a lot of time in his brief talking about the conspiracy offense and the fact that she had been acquitted and all that. The bottom line is that she was convicted of 10 substantive counts. They had each of the 10 people who testified to support that came in, the jury listened to them, and they saw it. And I submit that evidence and the evidence that we've identified under each of the counts supports the sufficiency of the evidence. With regard to Mr. Akiko, I'll point out that the court, when they instructed the jury, that statements made by the lawyers are not evidence. And I think that we've laid out and explained the scenario about when the attorney said he's a co-conspirator, that it was referring to the statement that was being offered. And then right after that, there was an objection to hearsay, and the judge overruled that. So it was clear that we were offering the statement as a co-conspirator statement. Now, with regard to Mr. Skripka, there's something in his reply brief that I want to address. He argues about Kerry Burrell, count 9, that he did not sign the CMN that relates to her count of conviction. On page 13 of my brief, I tried to break down each count and direct the court specifically to what exhibits and what testimony supports the conviction. And Mr. Akiko was convicted of count 9, just like Mr. Skripka. But what I didn't include in Mr. Skripka was the testimony that came from Lucy Rodriguez and Mr. Skripka's own cross-examination, where Skripka admitted that that was the CMN was signed by him. And he gave an explanation for why he had issued it when Carrie Burrell had testified she never saw a doctor whatsoever. There's a lot of material in this case. There's one correction I want to make with regard to the amount of loss. In there were three figures in the amount of loss. One was the billed amount, the amount that's allowed by Medicare, and then the amount that was paid. What Judge Gilmore did was that she said, I find that the amounts that were allowed by Medicare were the maximum amount, and that amount is what's going to justify the enhancement. And the first part of my brief, I talk about 11 counts. There were 10 counts of conviction. And then I talk about $9 million. It was the $11 million, and I believe that that's set forth a little later in the brief. Unless the court had, with regard to Mr. Skripka and his deliberate ignorance argument, Skripka testified that I'm not going to be just some ostrich sticking my head in the ground. I mean, if that can't demonstrate willful blindness, then the other statement that he made to Marguerite Hackney on January the 14th of 2003, that when she asked him about, well, what are you going to do when we demonstrate some of the evidence here against you, and he says, well, I'll just say you have to prove it, and then I'll just deny it. And so that kind of attitude continued that on March the 9th, he had an interview with Agent Judy Sly, and Judy Sly told him everything that Gottlieb had been doing. And yet, 3 weeks later, on March the 28th, Skripka, and he says, I don't know why I did it. He goes and opens up another bank account so that more money can be funneled into the bank account that was for Gottlieb that he took, and he gave blank checks for Mr. Gottlieb to be able to write on.
How about responding to this idea, suggestion, or argument that for a criminal trial, we can look to documents such as a congressional hearing to set aside a verdict?
Well, I submit, Your Honor, that the purpose for taking judicial notice is taking judicial notice of something that was brought out during the proceedings, and that for whatever reason it wasn't included in the record, and it was something that everybody can agree on. And as I point out in my reply brief, one of the things that Patel's trying to do is they were trying to show, oh, look at all the confusion between a motorized wheelchair and a scooter, and how doctors really don't know what they should be doing about it. Well, the thing is, that wasn't her defense. She always executed prescriptions for the motorized wheelchair. She never claimed, oh, I didn't know the difference between a scooter and a wheelchair. So, I mean, bringing that kind of evidence in when it wasn't relied on, her defense relied on Gottlieb, on the script, on the things that he supposedly told her, although she herself had executed the paperwork twice that she was going to comply with the rules of Medicare. So the government argues that this is just some new defense, newfangled theory that they didn't pursue when they had the opportunity to try.
All right. Thank you, Counsel.
All respect, is not a newfangled defense. Without suggesting that you read the congressional record in order to figure out whether or not the prove their case in this situation. What I'm suggesting to the court, not only is it highly appropriate for you all to understand the confusion that reigned during the time frame of question.
But how can we go outside and read some congressional hearing? I mean, this, we got to stay within the four corners of the trial record.
Your Honor, not to argue with the court, but under 201D in the cases I cited, stand for the specific proposition of appellate courts for the first time on appeal and take judicial notice. And what I'm suggesting to the court, the government's read to the CNN, look at these quote-unquote false statement she made on the CNN. CNNs are not even required to be filled out by federal statute. If you look at
that, well, that, no, again, that's the kind of thing that should have been covered at trial.
The court certainly can look at the Medicare regulations that are public in the United States Code. I mean, that's there. I mean, I don't see the problem with that.
Even if it's not raised at trial. I mean, we'll just have to look at it, but
well,
this is a...
the government wants you to figure this case out solely on the CNN, and I'm telling the court, as an officer of the court, that the CNN in this case, in fact, does not parrot the actual Medicare criteria. This business about is it...
Well, that, you know, that should have been covered by the defense at trial. It should have been contrasted.
You know, had I been trial attorney, I would have done it.
You hope you would have.
My hand hopefully not tied behind my back by pointing out that at least based upon this record, when you look at the CMN, the questions that are in the CMNs do not, in fact.
You know, that's like saying, well, if I'd been trial counsel, I'd have called another witness. So you need to consider what this witness would have said, because I've attached his affidavit to my brief.
All respect, I don't think it's anything like that, because what I'm asking the court to look at are the federal regulations relative to Medicare. The government has quoted, even cited regulations in the indictment. But if you look at the question about scratching out, as Judge Haynes pointed out, should it have been done? Probably not. That's not the way to do it. But that doesn't make her a criminal. In fact, she scratched it out, and on top of that, she put her initial to it. The business about 6 to 8 hours. Dr. Gottlieb instructed her that would be a fair average as to how long somebody would use a wheelchair, so she relied upon it. Maybe she shouldn't have. Maybe she should have had better schooling. But that doesn't make her a criminal. And in fact, the Medicare criteria doesn't have anything to do with it.
But isn't that uniquely what the jury decides? I mean, as your opponent said, they looked at her, they looked at the 10 witnesses that walked in and all of that whole story, and they just didn't buy this story that she was just wholly innocent, hear no evil, see no evil kind of person. I mean, they just didn't buy it, and that is uniquely something that an appellate court is not well situated to resolve.
Well, appellate court, with all respect, uniquely situated to make sure that the principle of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, notwithstanding a guilty verdict by a jury, is not diluted. You have to conduct a de novo review.
What evidence of intent would you expect us to find?
I would expect something that doesn't exist in this record, some kind of incriminating admission, some kind of testimony from one of their witnesses who can confirm that, in fact, she had a knowing, willful participation in this crime. What's interesting about this record, I've never seen one like it, is the government's own witnesses basically end up testifying for her. Dr. Gottlieb, their head snitch, says, she didn't inspire women. I didn't tell her to violate the law. I kept information from her. I misled her. I've never seen a record that has that kind of evidence that has to be considered with all respect by the court.
Thank you, counsel. We will look at the record closely.
I sure appreciate it.
I did want to address a couple of the points that Mr. Sassenberg made. The first is that, reviewing for oral argument, I did look at the record, and Dr. Skripka, on cross-examination, did state that he acknowledged he signed the CMN for Curie Burrell. There was some conflicting testimony earlier on, so it was the other testimony that in my reply brief I had cited. Mr. Babcock referred to the fact that Dr. Skripka stated that he put his
this was related to the bank accounts, which were opened after Dr. Skripka left the clinic and stopped working at the clinic. He had two interviews with the FBI. The first was with Agent Judy Sly, and my recollection of the record is different from Mr. Babcock's. Mr. Babcock says that that Judy Sly testified that she explained what Gottlieb was doing and that he understood what Gottlieb was doing and continued to work there. My recollection is that she just asked him questions and he answered questions, but that she didn't explain to him why they were there and what the purpose of the investigation was and what they believed Dr. Gottlieb was doing. So I asked the court to review Judy Sly's testimony on that issue. The second time he was interviewed was by, I believe, Agent Hackney on March 9th, and that is when he was told what was going on at the clinic, and in response he said, well, I didn't know that that's what's going on. And when he said, you have to prove I knew, what he was saying was, well, don't I have to know that this stuff's going on to be guilty of it? I didn't know. And if you consider me a suspect, I didn't know what Gottlieb was doing. Gottlieb hid all this stuff from me and lied to me. The other issue, I guess, about the 8 hours, because the CMN was to accompany a prescription, it's only natural to see it as looking prospectively. When the doctors put on there that the patient uses the wheelchair 8 hours a day, it's akin to writing a prescription saying take two times a day as needed. Because it's the CMN accompanies a prescription, it's not about something that happened in the past, it's about how the patient will be using it in the future. And this was brought up in...
I mean, you would think a well-educated person knows about verb tenses. It's kind of what your definition of is. So it's a temporal thing, uses, not
they,
will
they
use.
Cross that out.
No, I understand, but there's other sections pertinent to this. Unable to operate any type of manual wheelchair, that doesn't speak to the future. It speaks to the present. Requires speaks
right.
to the present.
But
I mean, everything's couched in the present in this form.
On those issues, yes. All those patients, they presented themselves, and they were all elderly Medicare recipients. Several were disabled, and they also, at least one admitted they were coached, and there was evidence that Maisha Burnett overheard patients being coached before they went into the examination.
To determine whether this error seriously affected the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings. The government's contention is that statements made by lawyers are not evidence in trial. That doesn't give them a pass if they say it in passing or an objection to say that he's a co-conspirator, thus taking away his presumption of innocence. That's a precious right which I'm proud to stand here to defend, and I would implore this court to protect it, and we would ask you to reverse the conviction.
May it please the court, unless there are any additional questions from the court this morning, I don't have any additional information for the court. Now give my time back.
All right. Thank you. Thanks, George.